welcome to Inside Out with me, Susan Madaris. In recent news, the Department of Justice conducted an unprecedented intrusion into the work of about 20 journalists affiliated with the AP. Behind me is the headquarters for the Associated Press here in New York City, where its president recently said that the intrusions have already affected news gatherings. Many sources are now reluctant and feel intimidated to step forward and share news. It has made sources less willing to talk to AP journalists, he said, and added that in the long term, it could limit America's information sharing from all news outlets. It was also described as unconstitutional. So the question many people are asking is why the crackdown by the Obama administration on not just AP reporters, but also Fox News reporters and whistleblowers as well. Join me on this edition of Inside Out as we take an in-depth look at the issue of cybersecurity in the United States in the 21st century, notably during the Obama administration. The House of Representatives passed a broad cybersecurity bill on April 18th that allows corporations to share customers' personal data with other firms and the U.S. government, even in cases in which a company has a signed contract explicitly vowing not to do so. The Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, known as CISPA, passed by a margin of 288 to 127, despite receiving a late veto threat from the Obama administration, which warned that the bill does not sufficiently protect civil liberties. The veto threat was particularly noteworthy, given the administration's Department of Justice has been urging Congress to expand its data gathering and cybercrime powers for years. Congress shelved a similar bill last year after the White House expressed its formal opposition. Supporters of the bill argue that it's needed to help the government protect key infrastructure and institutions from online attacks. They've also said the bill doesn't require companies or the government to monitor customer content, although it does authorize them to share personal account data, including emails and other information. Firms that voluntarily turn over such data would be immune from civil lawsuits.
So basically, private companies can share information and cybersecurity threats with the U.S. government without being held accountable, despite the fact that they might have prior agreements with their customers or prior arrangements as well. This has made many Americans worried on what their rights really are.
I didn't know that the cable companies could give information to the government without my consent, and I didn't know that. It's a little troubling to hear.
I actually was aware that there were laws where your phone or cable company could share information with the government. And when I did find that out, it actually made me a little more hesitant to share certain information on my phone. I still don't make regular phone calls, but I guess I'm a little more careful about what I text and email because of that.
Privacy and civil liberties advocates, including the American Civil Liberties Union, have blasted CISPA for overriding private contracts and authorizing both corporate and government access to personal information. To talk more about the issue, I headed to meet up with David Opterbeck, professor of law at Seton Hall University Law School, where he also serves as director of the Gibbons Institute of Law, Science, and Technology. His legal scholarship focuses on cybersecurity and civil liberties in cyberspace, patent and antitrust law, copyrights, and regulation of access to digital media. I started by asking him about the recent bill in Washington.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, cybersecurity has been on the agenda of Congress probably for at least 5 years as a major concern. There have been a number of efforts to pass some kind of bill, and you really have to think about it in terms of two tracks at least. One track is a broad compliance and standards type track. What sorts of protections should, say, an internet service provider have to secure data and to secure themselves against attack? The other track is an information track. What sorts of information should something like an internet service provider be either required or allowed to give to the government? And how should the government be able to use that information? So the most recent thing that was passed in the House was a version of CISPA, which is an information sharing provision. And that provision would allow, and in some cases require, private entities to share information about potential threats with the government and would allow federal authorities to use that information for a variety of purposes. And one of the problems, I think one of the main problems with CISPA has been and still is the breadth of purposes for which the government can use this information. So if you get information under a search warrant, you have a procedure, you have a court proceeding that you might be using it in, and to some extent at least, the uses of it are constrained. CISPA said that the information can be used for a variety of purposes, including broadly cybersecurity purposes. Now, as a lawyer, we think, well, what's the definition of cybersecurity purposes? It seems like it can encompass almost anything. And so you have concerns about whether different branches of the government, the National Security Administration, the FBI, the Justice Department, are going to be sharing information for purposes that just seem too broad. I think that's the big worry.
So is there a growing gap between privacy rights and personal information?
Sure, and that's always the constitutional tension, is civil liberties and security, and the federal government has a responsibility to preserve both at the same time. The interesting thing with cybersecurity is that so much of the infrastructure that handles information is privately held. So the main data pipes, for example, of the internet, very significant portion of those are privately owned. And so it's not like highways, which the government might have control of and might be able to shut down in the event of an emergency for some period of time, say if there's a hurricane. They're privately held, and so the government has to have some other sort of authority to be able to step in and do something in the event that there's an attack or an emergency or some need to do so.
Ofterbeck also notes that there needs to be limits on the president's executive power when it comes to cybersecurity. He refers to an option that has become known in recent years as the Internet Kill Switch, which is the cybercrime and cyber countermeasures concept of activating a single shutoff mechanism for all Internet traffic. The prospect of cyber warfare over the 2000s has prompted the drafting of legislation by U.S. officials. While the effects of shutting off information access are controversial, the topic of kill switch does remain an issue unresolved.
About 3 years ago, when Congress was first considering major cybersecurity legislation, they included an emergency powers provision, and it was kind of popularly called the kill switch. And it would have given the president authority to step in the event of a cyber attack or some kind of cyber emergency, and theoretically at least, shut down the internet. And that got a lot of us in the cyber civil liberties community very concerned. We look at things like the revolution in Egypt and other places where governments step in and try and control communications, and obviously that gets you a little bit worried.
However, he warns that some of the threats posed by the legislative body are real and must be taken seriously.
I attend various meetings with government officials, and they frequently talk about the degree of threat that we're facing. And the fact is that we're under attack, both private industry and the government is under attack 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Some of these intrusions and attacks they believe are coming from countries like China. Some of them are from private entities. Some of them are from organized crime. But there's constant efforts to steal trade secrets, to steal military information, as well as to compromise critical systems.
But what about the case like the one where AP phone records were seized by the Department of Justice? Has it not antagonized the press corps in a way not seen in years? And won't this move discourage sources, including whistleblowers, from speaking out in the public interest?
I mean, there's a number of issues that intertwine with this. There's, first of all, simply the issue of to what extent can the government monitor electronic communications. There are a number of laws that govern this. There are different rules for stored communications, for communications in progress. The other issue with the situation with the reporters is the question of sources. And it is sort of a traditional freedom of the press that there's at least some degree of freedom to protect sources. Otherwise, it would be really difficult to do certain kinds of investigative journalism. And again, the question is, when are there compelling national security or law enforcement needs that might require a source to be disclosed? And there have been cases throughout the years where reporters have gone to jail or things like that in order to not disclose their sources. So the legislative effort now is to try and come up with some kind of balance that would say in what circumstances a source may have to be disclosed or in what circumstance a source would be shielded. And it's a really difficult balance to draw.
And in many cases, current law does not require the government to provide us with notice at all. I asked my guests, is this a violation of the Fourth Amendment?
Yeah, I mean, to go through phone calls or electronic communications, there are a number of different standards, and you referenced the Fourth Amendment, and that's sort of the basic standard for a search and seizure. So under the Fourth Amendment, you need to show that there's a crime in progress or a crime is likely to be committed. You need to go to a court. You need to get some court approval. You don't always have to do that. There are things called communications data warrants that are a lower standard than a Fourth Amendment warrant to receive information about some kinds of electronic communications. There are stored data warrants, which again are a somewhat lower level. There are wiretap orders, which actually are a somewhat higher level. It's sort of a Fourth Amendment plus to get communications in progress. There's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is called FISA, which allows the government, without a warrant at all, simply getting an order from a court that actually meets in secret, to gather certain kinds of information if it relates to intelligence activities. So there's a range of things, and it really depends on what kind of activity is involved.
Perhaps the AP experience is a reminder of how much a citizen private information the government may demand, including the phone numbers we call, the email addresses we contact, and the websites we visit, and how easy our current law makes it for the government to get this information without us even knowing.
People don't realize the extent to which the law enforcement authorities, both at the state and federal level, already have the ability and have access to large amounts of personal information that is shared online. If you've ever heard the concept of a fusion center, these are existing centers now where state and local law enforcement work together to collate and correlate large amounts of data that have already been collected under search warrants or under wiretap warrants or under FISA or under other government programs that already allow this information to be collected. And so there is a concern about how much of that information is out there, where is it kept, how long is it kept, and for what purposes can it be used. The culture has changed broadly in the sense that people are much more comfortable putting a lot of things onto sites like Facebook that they in the past wouldn't really have shared with anyone outside of maybe a close circle of friends and family. And to some extent it may be that a site like Facebook gives a false sense that you're only sharing the information with that small group when in fact it is available to a much larger group. And to some extent, I think it's just a change in social norms and the way people think about information and the way they share information.
Your cable provider giving information to the government is sort of a slippery slope that should probably be regulated and have a more open forum where people can understand what's really going on. Because I don't think a lot of people understand that.
I think the best thing to do would be to use it to your advantage in case, you know, you're ever in a situation where you need to, you know, find out from the government what someone is saying if you ever find yourself in a legal battle.
President Barack Obama spoke of balance and told reporters that leaks related to national security can put people at risk. National security reporters' willingness to engage on several occasions suggested they already understand the risks. Major news outlets have held back information numerous times during the Obama years. The Huffington Post has reported on four instances over the past 9 months in which the media didn't publish information at the government's request, including details concerning the attack in Benghazi, Libya, the existence of a CIA drone base in Saudi Arabia, and the identity of the CIA agent who served as a model for the protagonist in the controversial Osama bin Laden hunting film Zero Dark Thirty.
So while many national security reporters listen to the administration's argument in not sharing information with the public due to security reasons, many are wondering whether or not the recent actions by the Department of Justice in its subpoena of AP records will ultimately prove that the relationship between the administration and the media is a one-way street.
My next stop was to meet with veteran journalist and commentator Don DeBar. He's currently radio host of the morning show airing on CPRMetro.org, or Community Progressive Radio Metro, which according to its mission statement was created to remedy the lack of media attention devoted to critical issues affecting our lives. I wanted to ask him about how he viewed the relationship between the government and the media.
The media in the United States is an interesting construct, kind of unique around the world. It's in the main privately owned, and particularly in the last 30 years and accelerating since the Telecom Act in 96, concentrated in a very few, very powerful hands. So it is not the standard model of government-controlled media. To the contrary, in fact, since the power centers really reside in private hands in the United States, it's more that the government and the media work for the same economic interests, the same powerful few people.
We quickly moved on to the topic of the Justice Department's tapping into the phone records of multiple Associated Press reporters. My guest tells me that this case, among others, fall under the Espionage Act of 1917, passed 2 months after the United States entered World War I. In the 90 years it's been in place, no administration has used it so liberally as the Obama White House.
The act that was employed to spy on the Associated Press, which is an organization, by the way, of it's a media collective. It's a non-profit organization that services the news industry with a lot of independent media also being represented. That act was first passed in the World War I era, the Espionage Act in 1917, 1918, I don't recall off the top of my head. And it hasn't been employed very often against almost anyone, except for the period immediately following its enactment, the Red Scare period after the Russian Revolution, up to the late 20s. But it has been employed in a couple of key cases and threatened to be employed in a couple of key cases involving media in the intervening period. One is the case of the so-called Pentagon Papers.
The Pentagon Papers was released by former United States military analyst Daniel Ellsberg, who, while employed by the RAND Corporation, participated in a national political controversy in 1971 when he released the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret Pentagon study of U.S. government decision-making in relation to the Vietnam War, to the New York Times and other newspapers. On Sunday, June 13, 1971, the Times published the first of 9 excerpts and commentaries on the 7,000-page collection. For 15 days, the Times was prevented from publishing its articles by court order requested by the Nixon administration. Meanwhile, Ellsberg leaked the documents to the Washington Post and 17 other newspapers. On June 30th, the Supreme Court ordered publication of the Times to resume freely in the court case New York Times Co. versus United States. All charges were eventually dropped against Ellsberg.
They threatened to use the Espionage Act against the New York Times and against the whistleblower for disclosing this information. But the use of it to conduct full-scale spying against the media is fairly unique, at least to the extent that it's come out in public.
I asked DeBar why he believes the Obama administration has been so aggressive on information sharing.
The part that's a disconnect for me isn't the fact that this is dissonant with the way he behaves in other areas, like whistleblowing. This is the most aggressive anti-whistleblowing administration in the history of the country, including Nixon. Rather, it's because he's been such a darling of the press that it's kind of puzzling to wonder why they would bother to target the press in this way, since he seems to do so well with them. But there's something deeper here, and that is that when you look at the type of information that is being culled generally, and the type of information that we're learning has been acquired against the Associated Press, you're not just talking about looking behind a particular story or finding out the identity of somebody leaking documents, of sources or whatever. You're also able to actually analyze for the first time, perhaps, the actual machinations of news collection and processing and distribution by looking at all of the activity. So you can understand how the Associated Press works, how individual reporters work, and all of that by studying the information being acquired, which puts you way ahead of them when it's time to release, press releases that are going to hopefully be reported as stories and, to communicate to the general public through the media.
Then there is the case of Fox News' James Rosen. What happened with Rosen was that the Obama administration insisted on keeping a search warrant to his private email account secret, arguing to a federal judge that the government might need to monitor the account for a long duration of time in case of any leaks. The reason for this action came from an article he wrote back in 2009 about North Korea, which then sparked an investigation.
Information sharing is something that governments historically have been hostile to, because information is power. If you control the public narrative, then you can control the public more or less. And that has been known for hundreds of years. And it's part of the genesis of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution in the 18th century. The loss of the independence of the U.S. media really is something that's been only accelerating, that took place in the 1960s and 1970s. And the rise of the internet has provided models of communication that are much more democratic if they're allowed to be fully expressed. People finding out through the media that the media has been spied on, and reading elsewhere about the other offenses like embedding and et cetera, hopefully realize that they have to be more affirmative and aggressive about acquiring information from multiple sources and learning how to be critical about the information so they can find out what is really going on. And I'm hoping that that's going to be the result.
With the rise in citizen journalism, there's a growing concern that there is no law, at least federally, to allow journalists to protect their sources. Many argue that the issue of cybersecurity threats are real and must be taken into consideration. But what about freedom of press? How far is too far? Thanks so much for joining us on this edition of Inside Out. Remember, you can always send me your emails to insideout@susanmodiris.com. You can also follow me on Twitter for latest updates and information. Until next week and another show from New York City, goodbye.